So we'll have to.
And you've shared a night again. It starts again. It's about the whole
routine
starts again.
Yeah, we're back to full schedule.
You can go online and listen.
Full compliments and schedule. All right. Now, does anybody recall what the last thing we discussed was?
When was that?
January 23rd. Exactly.
Let's start with if anybody remembers when it was.
January 23rd.
What's today's date?
Why you ran to that place? Yes, yeah, the whole thing about that place, and you pulled up the rock. Map.
We got one step further than that.
We got past the rock, yeah.
Yeah, we got one step further. We went through the story of the extradition of Shimshon by Bnei Yehuda to the Shoftim, to Plishtim. And then I believe we even read the story in Sefer Shmuel that parallels the issue of extradition, the story of Sheva ben Bichri.
Right.
Shmuel. Where Sheva ben Bichri is this rebel against David HaMelech, and he runs to the city of Hamachola, and they Yoav surrounds the city with his army,
and they turn him over.
And they not only turn him over, they execute him, and they throw his head over the ramparts in order to.
Oh, I was here for that.
Yes, you remember that part.
She remembers the good part.
Yeah, it's kind of like a scene right out of The Lord of the Rings.
That's right.
But that's when we were talking about extradition. Okay, if somebody is, if you ask for someone by name.
Well, that's exactly what we're going to get to. So that's where we were up to. Correct.
Okay.
I think we started that discussion, and I don't know if we finished it. So we're going to start it again, just so that we put everybody on the same page. Having read the story of Sheva ben Bichri, we can now compare the two. That's really what the halacha does. Is it compares the two. This comparison of the story of Shimshon and the effort by Bnei Yehuda to take Shimshon, extradite him to the Plishtim in order to get him out of their hair. And
so to speak,
right. We'll get to the hair. Yeah, I forgot that was not an intended pun, but it was
it worked.
Very good.
Mitch would be proud of me.
That's what Shmuel was.
And the story of Sheva ben Bichri, where they also are threatened by Yoav, not a Gentile army, but nonetheless an external army, also saying, "Give us so and so, or we will kill you all," judging them all as aiders and abettors to somebody guilty of treason and insubordination against the king, and ultimately they executed him and handed his head over to Yoav's forces, thereby securing peace for the city. Those are the two stories, in a nutshell. And when the Mefarshim and the halachic sources discuss the issue, not of Shimshon and not of Shoftim, they approach to the issue comes from the halachic side, which is what's the status of extradition, etc. These are the two paradigm stories in Tanakh that stand as the guidelines and comparisons to what to do with this issue. So if we go back to the source page, and this is a copy of it if anybody doesn't have it. Open two copies. Yep. If anybody's missing.
We got it last time.
I added a few tips. Right. So we're gonna start with source number two. Source number two is the Tosefta in Masechet Truma. It's the primary source for the discussion in the halacha. Si'a shel bnei adam, group of people. Now, this group of people can be the people of a city. It can be Adini. You look confused.
No, it's okay. You had another TED.
Yes, I've had a few of them. So this is, it's a different source page, but that's fine. Different parts of the parak. Okay. Si'a shel bnei adam she'amru lehem goyim, tnu lanu echad mikem v'nahargeu, ve'im lav haray anu horgin et kulchem. This case, group of people, they can be a stationary group of people, meaning the people living in a city. They can be a transitory group of people traveling along the road. And they encounter a Gentile hostile force. as we see from the story of Sheva Ben Bechri, the notion that it's a Gentile force isn't necessarily a requirement in the halachic issue. It's just that that's the normal context in which the halacha would have discussed such a scenario. It's not, especially post, when you're dealing with halacha, you're dealing with a world of Mishnah and Gemara, you're dealing with a post-Malchus experience. So in a post-Malchus experience, you don't have as the notion of treason and insubordination and the kind of context of Sheva Ben Bechri. So the notion of a Jewish threat coming from Jewish sources in this regard would not be as likely as from a Gentile threat. Nonetheless, the threat being, give us one of your members and so that we may kill them, or else we will kill you all. The assumption here is that it doesn't matter whom. They're not requesting anybody in particular. It doesn't matter who. They just want somebody. They want to make a model out of somebody, kind of thing. This, by the way, just to change subjects for a second, was not an uncommon phenomenon, unfortunately, during the Holocaust. This was a very practical issue that came up many times because the Nazis had quotas of how many people they had to take out, execute, or whatever. And so the notion of, we don't care who, we just want five people, you know, you could tell us who became a very major issue for unfortunately, in recent generations. Nonetheless, the halacha says, Yahargu kulan ve'al yimasu lehem nefesh achat miYisrael. The first line of reasoning in the halacha is that we don't have the right to choose who's going to be killed. One person blood is not redder than another's, and therefore we are basically going to take the approach of Shev Al Ta'aseh. We don't do anything, sit back, don't do a thing, can't actively hand somebody over, and therefore even if it threatens everybody, but that's their issue, not ours, we didn't actively hand somebody over to the Gentile. That's the first line of reasoning.
That's what I thought the halacha would be.
Right.
When we discussed
this. And that was sort of where we started our conversation, where I asked the question generically, and that's the first line of thinking. However, then the Tosefta goes on and says, Aval, im yichaduhu lahem, kegon sheyichadu l'sheva ben bechri, yitnu lahem va'al yihargu kulan. But if the Gentiles are not asking for a generic, you give us anybody, and we're not choosing who to hand over, but rather they're asking for a very specific person, ostensibly because he's guilty of some crime or whatever it is, whatever the context is, like in the case of Sheva Ben Bechri, where they said, we want so-and-so, and by extension, I would assume the same could be applied to Shimshon, then you are allowed to hand that person over, because you are no longer choosing whom to hand over to the Gentiles. You are essentially saving the lives of the rest of the community of Israel by acquiescing to the request that has already been made.
That's totally difficult.
But that is, in fact, how... And otherwise, the story of Sheva Ben Bechri is difficult to understand, as is the story of Shimshon. Maybe other ways to understand them, but for now, that's certainly the argument. And if we followed that line of reasoning by itself, plug it back into the two stories that we're working with, call it extradition, it's really an execution, but call it the extradition of Sheva Ben Bechri could be justified on these grounds, as would be the extradition of Shimshon by Bnei Yehuda. And in fact, I'm going to skip for a moment. I'll come back to the next two paragraphs in this halacha in a second, but skip down to source 6, which is the Shulchan Aruch. How this halacha gets paskined in the Shulchan Aruch in the first paragraph. Avdei kochavim shamu li Yisrael tnu lanu echad mikem v'nargenu. This is the Ramah. Gentiles say, give us one of your number that we may kill them. Lo yitnu lehem echad. You may... You may not hand somebody over. Ela im ken yichaduhu ve'omru tnu lanu ploni. Unless they specifically asked for so and so. In other words, this position that is articulated in the first paragraph in the Tosefta, that Sheva ben Bichri becomes a paradigm applicable to halacha, is in fact the first argument, the first position in the Rambam. Now, there is, however, a qualification of this halacha, and that is the second paragraph. Amar Rabbi Yehuda. Came along Rabbi Yehuda, and Rabbi Yehuda made a different argument. He said as follows, "Bamed dvarim amurim." When was this halacha said? Specifically, when was the halacha said that if the Gentiles come and they say, "We want one of you," without necessarily specifying whom, that you're not allowed to hand them over? Bizman shehumi bifnim vehemi bachutz. That's at a time when the person or the group of people that they're seeking from are inside, hidden, secured, contained, and everybody else is outside. What's the rationale? We'll see in a moment. Aval bizman shehumi bifnim vehemi bifnim. But if they're all inside, and they're all contained, and therefore, by extension, they're all in danger because there's nowhere for them to go. Ho'il v'hu ne'erag v'hei ne'eragin. Since in the end, if you don't hand somebody over, you're all going to be killed. Yitnuhu lahen va'al yahargu kula. Then you can hand somebody over and not risk the lives of everybody. In other words, here I don't need to specify the individual. According to this argument, the very fact that the individual in question is essentially, or the potential group of individuals in question are essentially in a different location or in a different position to the rest of them, means that the level of danger is not equal to both.
Wait, say that again.
The level of danger, what essentially is arguing, the inside and the outside is about a city, right? So who's inside the city and who's outside the city. But essentially the argument is the level of danger equal to all of them? If the level of danger is equal to all of them, if you don't hand somebody over, they're all going to get killed. The second argument says you can hand somebody over, even if they're not specified. Because the level of danger is equal to them all. They're all in danger. And there's no option for escape. Whereas, if the situation is such where there's an option for escape, there's an option to run away, there's an option to the level of danger is not equal to all of them, that's where we would apply the halacha that you have to try some other alternative first.
But you know, this is kind of a guessing game.
I it mean, is.
You
it's,
don't
it's,
actually know just because you think that that's what's going to happen.
Well, remember, the halacha presents... Halacha presents hypothetical scenarios,
oh,
right?
That.
And then bishas ma'isa, you have to apply which one of those scenarios is applicable, right?
Is
you have
the
to
head of the organization.
That's really a much more practical question that's less relevant really to the theory of the halacha than it is to the application of it.
So it seems like if it's the distinction would be easier if you're. It's like everybody's trapped in a walled city.
Right. And that's exactly what the Gemara is trying to address. Now, it's what's the difference between, or is there a difference between the story of Shimshon and the story of Sheva ben Bichri? That's essentially what
in
the story of Sheva ben Bichri, they were all contained within the walls of the city.
Oh, okay.
It was a siege.
Yeah.
The city was under siege. And that's exactly where it goes. V'cheinu omer, v'tavo ha'isha u'kol ha'am b'chochmata. When she goes to the inhabitants of the city, b'chochmata, in her wisdom, what essentially is she saying? She's saying that, remember the, took a quick glance back at the story, Shmuel Bet Perek Chaf, she doesn't really, it doesn't say it here. I'll show you where it says it. It's in the Radak. But here in the Pasuk, at the end of Perek Chaf, Vatavo Ishal Kol Ha'am B'chochmata, this woman came to the inhabitants of the city in her wisdom.
136.
Shmuel Bet Perek Chaf, the end of Perek Chaf, page 20.
What
Chafbet 22. Chafbet. Vatavo Isha akol ha'am b'chokhmata v'yichletu et Rosh Sheva ben Bechri v'yashlich el Yoav. She came to the city in her wisdom. She had a way to save the city from the pending danger. And they cut off Sheva ben Bechri's head and they threw it over the ramparts. What was the argument? So here, okay, that's fine. That's what it says. Let's go back to the source for a second. Amrale, what did she say to them when it says that she approached the members of the city b'chachmata? What was her chachma? That's it. What was the chachma here? Says the Tosefta or Rabbi Yehuda, her chachma was Amralehen ha'il v'hu nerag v'atem neragin tnu lehem al tergu kochem. Since in the end we're all going to get killed, you might as well give him up and then save the inhabitants of the city. Now it's here, I'm not relying, I don't need to come to the argument of only if they designate an individual. Here I'm working off the argument that it's better to save the majority of the people, even at the risk or even at the expense of one life, because it's a numbers game. So Buda actually seems to be saying that we're going to play the numbers game. Mm-hmm. You have 100 people in the city and they're all going to be killed. You can kill one person and save 100. Then it's a net gain of 99. Right.
And do you believe them?
Yeah, I would assume you. We're assuming all other factors being equal. I mean, obviously, if they're not going to believe them. If you start throwing in other variables, do you believe them? If you not believe them, are you all going to be killed anyway, etc.? Then, of course, the scenario is going to change. But remember that halacha deals with hypothetical scenarios in order to establish rulings, concepts. So here's the concept. There may be other variables applicable in practical terms, but that's not the issue. The issue is what is the theory behind the principles that we're applying. So in the first opinion, which is the opinion of Tanakama, the first opinion of the Tosefta, the theory was, I can't play the numbers game. I don't have that authority. Unless the Gentile is designating who they want. The second opinion of Rabbi Yehuda says, no, we can play that numbers game. If we can save the majority of lives by offering one, or a minority, then that's a valuable asset. That's assuming, of course, as he presents it, kulam mibifnim, meaning there's no options for escape. There's no alternative options.
It's a walled city.
Right? A walled city. They're all engaged. Now, that works for Sheva ben Bechri.
Are they doing this on some kind of a... I mean, where are they taking this from? They're just using this as an example? Are they taking it from an example? Are they looking at it from a historical... I'm trying to understand how they're coming up with this.
It's a hard question to answer because when you start looking at halachic sources, you're looking at them in isolation.
Yeah.
Right? You have to read the Mishnayos and Trumah, which is where it's based on, etc., so there's a broader context to it. The fact is that this was probably not such an uncommon scenario in certain periods of history. But it's also true that there were biblical precedents for these things. So you can start the argument from either the biblical precedent or you can start the argument from the historical precedent. Either way, for our purposes, since we're learning Tanakh, we're working our way backwards. We're working at the halachic sources because they keep referencing the biblical paradigms. And we're going to take those and then reapply them backwards into the world of Tanakh because we have... And it's an interesting exercise. The halacha refers to one story. We have two. So what we're really trying to do is take the halachic sources dealing with the story of Sheva ben Bechri and then apply them to Shimshon. So we're playing the triangle. And what we end up with is various opinions are going to take us to a different conclusion with Shimshon. That's the beauty of it.
Out of the triangle.
Right. Correct. Because then we're going to say, are they parallel or not? So if the issue is... If the Gentiles designate, or if the enemy, let's call the enemy. If the enemy designates the wanted person, then you're allowed to extradite. Then Sheva ben Bechri is exactly the same as Shimshon. And that we saw as the first opinion. If, however, Rabbi Yehuda's position is, the secondary question is whether Rabbi Yehuda and the first opinion are arguing or they're building one on the other. But let's assume for the moment they're arguing. If Rabbi Yehuda's opinion is that I'm allowed to play the numbers game, but only if the individuals in question are in the same location and in the same level of entrapment.
The danger.
In the same level of danger as the person in question. So they're all inside the walled city. They're all contained. There's no option for escape for any of them. Then I'm allowed to play the numbers game. Whereas if I have an option of escape, one's inside, one's outside type of thing, then it's a different scenario. Now, where does the humi b'fnim v'hemi b'chutz come from? Where does that scenario come from? I understand a walled city. What's going on here? So here, the Radak seems to suggest that what's in the background, it's not stated here, but what's in the background is the story of Shimshon. Because Shimshon is a little different than Sheva ben Bichri. There's no walled city here. He's in hiding. Where is he in hiding?
In a rock.
In a hole in the ground. Like somebody else we once knew recently was hiding in a hole in the ground. He's in hiding.
Lahavdo.
Lahavdo. What?
Only
right, Lahavdo. So take a look now at the Radak. I'm going to skip. We'll come back to the sources in the middle. Let's jump to the Radak. Really very interesting scenario, story in the Radak.
Sheva?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. The principle of, you know, if you save one life, you save
the whole world.
How does that fit there?
If you sacrifice one life in order to save 99, so you give up one world to save 99 worlds. Okay. Again, this is the argument. Do you play the numbers game or don't you play the numbers game?
The result is going to be what you want it to be.
That's Janet's question. You have to work off a hypothetical scenario. Assuming that the results are here, right, so we're dealing with a theoretical question. Theoretical question is, can you sacrifice one life for the sake of it?
Right.
The judgment call of the application of that is a whole different issue.
Right.
But the thing is, you never know. Like in the Holocaust, the big question is, why didn't we protest? Why didn't we protest sooner? Why didn't we fight back?
You know, I don't know if that's really the same issue.
But I'm saying we didn't know that, you know, I mean, we didn't know what the end of the story was going to be. We didn't know how crazy this guy was. So we're thinking, you know.
Yeah, obviously, in practical terms, once you start applying it to practical scenarios, it's a very different, much more complex world. Much more complex world. I have the luxury of not having to do that. I only have to apply it to a very specific story,
right.
And the outcome of which we know. So I'm.
It's a lot easier.
Yeah.
Hypotheticals are always easier.
Yeah, much, much easier. That's right. I'll stick to theory for now. Says the Radak. Now, this Radak is in Sefer Shmuel. So the Radak here is really talking about the story of Sheva ben Bichri. It's the Radak who links Sheva ben Bichri to Shmuel explicitly. And he does so through this scenario. Let's take a look. When she comes to the city of Chochmata, what's the Chochma? Everybody's trying to figure out what the Chochma here is, that this woman came to the inhabitants of the city and offered some wise insight. Says the Radak, Lefi shaita ha'ir mibnei Binyamin, since this city, Eva Mochola, was part of Shevet Binyamin, hayta tzricha lifatotam b'divrei chochma, she had to seduce them or entice them with wisdom. In other words, she had to convince them that she was correct, because Sheva ben Bichri was from Sheva ben Binyamin. So they were naturally tied or naturally aligned with his reasoning. What was his argument? His argument was, David is from Shevet Yehuda. He's trying to impose his Malchus on us. With all of the baggage that David HaMelech carried with him over the years, especially in the post-Batsheva era, he says, what We're independent. We're from Shevet Binyamin. We don't want Shevet Yehuda. So she had to convince them with Chochma, she argu Shevet ben Bichri levado, va'al yargu kulam, that they should in fact execute Shevet ben Bichri and spare the inhabitants of the city. What did she say? Amra lehem, so now the Radak is trying to understand the Chochma. This city is on the verge of being captured or conquered. Don't think that if he walks into the city, he's going to take out what they call a not pinpointed out. What's the expression?
A token?
No, a precision attack. Mm-hmm. It's going to take out just Sheva Ben Bechri.
Targeted,
thank you. Targeted attacks and take out Sheva Ben Bechri and leave the rest of us unharmed. Not going to happen. Why? Because he's going Yachshov Otanu Kulanu Kimordim B'machut, because we aided and abetted a traitor. Once he conquers the city, if we don't make peace with him, he's going to conquer us all. He'll kill us all. He says to the people, if treason is a capital offense. And then she quotes the verse from Sefer Yeshua or Sefer Shoftim that proves that, in fact, treason is a capital offense. Kol ish asher yamre et picha v'lo yishmat varecha l'chol asher tetzavenu yumat. Sefer Yeshua, God says, any person who violates your law will be killed. V'chein emru atat nu lemat anashim b'nei b'liyal asher b'givau nimitem. Sefer Shoftim later on, Perek Chaf, we'll see another case of treason, capital offense. That's her chachma. Now, says the Radak, u'bedivrei chazal, in the language of Chazal, in the halachic terminology, and he's going to quote our Tosefta, si'asha b'nei adam shamru lehem tnu lanu echad mikem v'narog oto, if you have a group of people who say, give us one, we'll kill him, v'im lav harei anu horgim et kulchem, and if not, we'll kill you all, yihargu kulam v'ayim asu lehem nefesh achat. Let them all be killed and not hand over one. V'im yichaduhu lehem, k'gon shiyichadu l'sheva ben b'chri, yitnu lehem v'ayargu kulam. If they designate somebody, then that's okay. Opinion one. Opinion two. Amar Reb Yehuda, Eimatai, when is this the case? Only bizman shehu mibifnim vehemi b'chutz. There's a whole discussion with Reb Yehuda is coming to qualify the notion of designation. Or he's coming to give a separate opinion. But let's work off the assumption that he's coming to qualify the designation. The Gentile comes and says, we want Ploni, we want Sheva Ben Bechri, or we want Shimshon, or we want so-and-so. So the first opinion says, if they designate the individual, you can give him up. The second opinion seems to say, you can only give him up if the level of danger is equal to all. What's this issue? He is inside, they're outside. Where does that come from? He says, that story is essentially the story of Shimshon. What's going on with Shimshon? Shimshon could have run away. Shimshon wasn't contained. There wasn't a sieged city. Shimshon is sitting in the cleft of a rock. And everybody else is outside. So where's the level of danger? The level of danger is the Gentile wants Shimshon. They want Shimshon, so Shimshon to run away. I don't have to hand Shimshon over to the Gentile. The people themselves are not in danger. There's an option. Shimshon haya yochol lehimalet. Could have run away. Shaya mibifnim. Shimshon was inside. Besela etam, in the rock. They're all outside. It's not an equal level of danger. Turn to Shimshon and say, Shimshon, we're in danger. Goodbye. Go run away. Go find some other cleft or some other rock. He'll get up. He'll run away. You turn to the plishtim and you say, oh, he's gone. What's the issue here? Sheva Ben Bechri is a city under siege. So there, I understand. So there you have to hand him over. Shimshon? You don't have to hand Shimshon over. You just tell Shimshon to run. So now, if that's the case, so ask me the obvious question.
Once they ran away, then they'd probably kill them all anyway.
No. The assumption, they only want Shimshon. They only want Shimshon.
Why didn't he run away?
Why didn't they ask him to run away?
Or why didn't he on his own run away?
Why didn't he run away? So, but the way the Radak presents it, send third option, which is why do they bother extraditing him? Why do they come to him? So he says, L'fichach lo natnu ela midato. That's why they didn't extradite him. They didn't come to him and kill him or take him and capture him. What did they do? They sent 3,000 designated representatives of Shevet Yehuda to negotiate with him. They went down to Shimshon and they said to Shimshon, would you mind? Would you be so kind? Would you help us out here? And remember, what was Shimshon's response?
Timing up or something?
He says, as long as you're not prepared to fight with me. Right, as long as you have not come to harm me. And they said, well, yeah, we're not going to touch you. Believe me, we're not going to touch you. We wouldn't dream of it. Right? It was the last thing in the world they wanted to do. 3,000 of them. Lonatnu elamidatos, says the Rambam. They didn't extradite him. We've got the wrong image. We're comparing the story of Shimshon to the story of Sheva ben Bichri, says the Radak. It's a wrong comparison. In case of Sheva ben Bichri, they extradited him. That's what the halachic principle is. In the case of Shimshon...
Cut him up and then
throw him. Well, yeah, right. Same thing. Okay, we'll get to that.
I'll call that.
Well, we'll get to that. We'll get to that third difference in a moment. Yeah. We'll get to that third difference in a moment. Janet, we'll get to that third difference in a moment. But conceptually, at this point, it comes to the same thing.
Okay.
Right, whereas with Shimshon, they didn't extradite him at all. Asking his permission to willingly give himself over to the plishtim is not extradition. Right? He may look like he's in chains, but he's not.
Why did they just ask him to leave, period?
They could have asked him to leave. Essentially the same thing. But I figured it was safer if they handed him over to the plishtim. Get him out of their hair. If he had refused, I suspect, according to the Red Dax interpretation, the next thing they would have said to him, okay, well, if that's the case, do us a favor and just find some other rock to lie under.
Get out of here.
Get out of our territory.
Yeah, I suspect that if had he refused to be handed over, that's what they would have. That would have been their next negotiating tactic. However, now let's go back to the story of Sheva ben Bichri. Aval hu vehem mibifnim, if they're all inside the city, ho'il vehu ne'rag vehem ne'ragim, if they're all going to be killed, yitnu lehem v'ayargu kulam, then you can hand them over. Kugon shu omer v'tabo yishal kolam chokhmata. And that's precisely how he understands this distinction. So according to these two pictures, I have option A and option B. First opinion that says the moment they designate him, they're allowed to extradite. That halachic principle would allow us to see the story of Sheva ben Bichri exactly the same as the story of Shimshon. They quote-unquote extradited Sheva ben Bichri, wanted alive, dead or alive. So they complied somewhere along the line. And they did so with Shimshon, which may explain why Shimshon said to them, are you going to harm me, right? If they want me dead or alive, as long as you're not prepared to do it Sheva ben Bichri style. Right? Although Sheva ben Bichri hadn't happened yet, but conceptually. Right? So the answer was no. The second opinion, which is that of the Radak, is that the two stories are completely different. That's the second opinion of Rabbi Yehuda. And although Rabbi Yehuda never says it, I think what the Radak is alluding to is the fact that standing behind this distinction are the fact that there are two stories in Tanakh. And so the distinction between the story of Sheva ben Bichri and the story of Shimshon creates this distinction in halacha between levels of danger. Rabbi Yehuda never links the two explicitly, but I think that that's essentially what the Radak is suggesting. And in which case, extraditing Shimshon would not have been a desirable scenario or an acceptable scenario. Says the Radak, they didn't extradite him. We're reading it wrong. They went to him, negotiated with him, asked his permission. He gave himself up willingly. And then the story is a very different one. Well, options one and two.
How do we get the heter then for the B'nai Ben Yomin to kill Sheva ben Bichri? They didn't extradite him.
We're not there yet. Now we're going to get there. Third option. Third opinion. Now, this third opinion is interesting because there's let's take a look at it. It's a new opinion. A third opinion. Says, take a look in the Tosefta. Third paragraph. Reb Shimon Omer. Kach amra lehem, when she, in her wisdom, spoke to the inhabitants of the city, and she argued for removing Sheva ben Bichri from the equation. She didn't argue, according to the first opinion, he was designated, we don't have to worry about making the choice. She didn't argue the levels of danger are equal, we're all going to get killed. She argued something else completely. Namely, Kol ha-mored b'machut Beit David chayav mita. She had a different argument. Sheva ben Bechri is guilty of treason. The man is guilty of a capital offense. We're not talking about just handing over an innocent soul. We're not talking about the comparison, chas v'shalom, to the Nazis. We're talking about a guy who's guilty of high treason against the king. And a harbor criminal who's guilty of high treason. And it was in public. It wasn't like he was even in secret. It was in public declaration. Take the guy, chop off his head, execute him, get rid of the criminal, be done with it. That was her argument. Sheva ben Bechri is guilty of a capital offense.
So it wasn't like he was innocent, like they were turning over an innocent.
Correct. He's not innocent at all. He's in fact guilty of a crime for which he forfeits his life.
Treason.
Which would explain why they killed him. They didn't just hand him over. They lobbed his head over the wall.
Oh my gosh.
So then where do we get the derivation from this story then? I mean, that's the
derivation to?
About turning over one person where they're surrounded. Right.
So what does Reb Shimon say? That's exactly Reb Shimon. Reb Shimon's argument is that it only is applicable for somebody who is guilty of treason.
Rebelling against the king.
You want to extrapolate from Sheva ben Bechri, then extrapolate correctly, right. Which is that the person has to be guilty of a capital crime of
so
treason.
Would have been
killed anyway. He forfeits his life.
So that doesn't really, that's not the same thing.
That certainly would not
be
applicable
more like
to
harboring a fugitive.
Correct.
Right.
Correct. So says Reb Shimon. Now, the interesting question is Reb Shimon a third opinion? Or is he qualifying the previous opinions?
I think he's qualifying.
Yeah. In the way it's formulated here, Reb Shimon Omer, Kach Amra Lehem, it's a third opinion. And the way it's formulated here, it's a third opinion. Mm-hmm. However, take a look down, I'll show you the Rambam in a moment, skip the Rambam, look at source 5. Source 5 is the Yerushalmi. The Yerushalmi, the Jerusalem or Palestinian Talmud, the Jerusalem Talmud, when it quotes this to Sefta, quotes it slightly differently from the text that we have. So look. Tani, meaning brighter. Siat b'nei Adam she'yu ma'achim b'derech ufagu behem goyim. I'm just rereading the same Tosefta. V'yamru tnu lanu echad mikem v'narog oto v'im lav harayanu hogim et kulchem. Same scenario. Give us one and we'll kill you all. Afilu kulan ne'eragin lo yimasu nefesh echad mi'Yisrael. Even if they're going to be killed, you cannot hand over one of Israel. First opinion. Second opinion. Yichaduhu lahen echad. But if, that's actually part of the first opinion, if they designated somebody, kigon Sheva ben Bechri, yimaslu oto v'lo yihargenu, then you can hand them over and not be killed. Amar Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish, v'hu sheyehei chayav mita, provided that person is already guilty of a capital crime, kisheva ben Bechri. V'Rabbi Yochanan amar, af al pi she'eino chayav mita, even if he's not guilty of a capital offense. In other words, according to the way the Yerushalmi understands, Rabbi Shimon is coming to qualify the designation. The first opinion says if you designate somebody, then you're not making the decision. The Gentiles have made the decision, so you can hand them over. To which Rabbi Shimon says, not so fast. If the Gentiles designate an innocent soul, then the numbers equation is still relevant. Who gave you the right to take an innocent soul and sacrifice them for the sake of everybody else? Infinity times infinity is still infinity. But if the Gentiles are designating a non-innocent soul, somebody guilty of a capital offense, somebody's guilty of treason against the king, it's a different issue. Right? Now, what's interesting is when the Rambam quotes this halacha, when the Rambam formulates halachically a conclusion, that's how he reads this braita, the way the Yerushalmi reads it. Look at source 4, second paragraph. V'im yichadu lehem yamut luna ploni o narogat kulchem, if they designate somebody, v'im hu chayav mitak, k'shev ben b'chui yitnu ota lehem. Then, if that person is guilty of a capital offense, then you can hand them over. Which is certainly only applicable to the story of Sheva ben Bichri, not to
Shimshon.
Says the Ramah, remember I showed you the Ramah in the Shulchan Aruch, source 6, the first paragraph, he quoted the first opinion, that if they designate the individual, then they may hand him over. If you take a look at the second paragraph, V'yesh omim dafil b'chahai gavne en l'mosro ela imken chayav mita k'sheva ben Bichri. He quotes this Rambam, that the designation of an individual by the Gentiles for execution is, you can participate, but only if the person designated is himself guilty of such a crime.
That really changes everything.
It changes the equation. It's a completely different halachic position, and it's a different reading of the story of Sheva ben Bichri. No longer is the story of Sheva ben Bichri a model of Gentile comes and says, designation, the enemy comes and says, we want a token Jew to execute, doesn't matter who, we're going to execute them, and this innocent soul, one innocent soul against 100. Now you can go with a whole different scenario. You're harboring a fugitive. You're harboring somebody who's guilty of treason. Do you put the city at risk to harbor a fugitive, to protect the fugitive, or you give him up, and the Gentiles clearly are going to execute him, fairly or unfairly, with justice, without justice, you don't know, but they're going to execute him. But you're endangering the lives of everybody in the city by harboring this fugitive.
But Shimon was not.
Well, we're going to get to Shimshon in a second. So, according to that,
is it only for somebody who's committed treason?
No, any capital offense.
Okay, which includes
murder,
offenses in the Bible. Murder,
adultery, a lot of capital offenses in Tanakh. Yes, it is. Idol worship is a capital offense.
Right.
But the one that's most, the one that's clearest is treason, because first of all, that's the case here, and second of all, it was very public.
Yeah.
So you don't have to worry about guilt, innocent until proven guilty, etc. I mean, this is clear. Now, from a pshat perspective, the story of Sheva ben Bichri, of the three opinions that we've seen, probably self-evident to which is the closest to pshat.
Because
The third one, because the whole story revolves around his rebellion against David HaMelech. Yoav's after him only because he's rebelled against the king. The whole context of that story is the integrity of Malchus Beis David against those trying to rebel, the rebellion of Avshalom, etc. The whole context of the Sefer is about the integrity of David's reign. So that's so dramatically different from the story of Shimshon. Shimshon's not guilty of a capital offense. Au contraire. Shimshon is the only one standing up for Jewish interests here.
Right?
He's the only one standing up against the enemy who's... Right? If anybody's guilty of, in a certain sense, treason against Israel, it's Bnei Yehuda, which we'll get to in a moment. So, if I come back to the comparison of Sheva ben Bichri and Shimshon, according to this third opinion, there's no comparison. They're not the same. So, come back to the question of why did they extradite him? The answer is probably along the similar lines to what we said for in the Radak. Radak also saw them as different. What was his solution? What was his answer as to why they extradited him?
Because they were in and they were out.
No. What was his answer? His answer was that they didn't extradite him.
Oh, okay.
Right.
They didn't forcibly extradite him. What did they do?
They asked
his permission. They went to him. They negotiated with him. They asked his permission. So the moment the stories are not parallel, then I'm not worried about why Bnei Yehuda forced Shimshon out of hiding. They didn't force him anywhere. They asked him nicely, politely.
Please.
3,000 against one. Please.
It never came to that.
Never came. He was willing to do.
Instead of extraditing, why don't they just ask him to leave?
It's a lot safer to hand him over.
Yeah.
I mean, for their sake, you mean?
It's a lot more secure.
Right.
Yeah.
That's true.
It's a lot. It's a lot.
That's true.
More secure for them. What happens if they ask him to leave?
And he does.
Even if he does, what does the police chief turn around and say? You had him and you let him go, right? So you're essentially aiding and abetting a terrorist.
No matter.
Remember, they're looking at Shimshon as the terrorist.
Right.
So.
That's different.
Just extrapolate the story backwards. That's options 1, 2, and 3.
There's another one, it
yes.
sounds like.
There's a fourth. There's a fourth.
Stay tuned.
There's a fourth way to look at the whole story. Both Sheva ben Bichri and Shimshon. What's the fourth way to look at the story? We've been applying the principle of the Gentiles will come and say, give us so-and-so or we'll kill you all. But let's take those people out of the equation for a second and look at it from a different perspective. Sheva ben Bichri for a moment. Sheva ben Bichri is a person who has committed treason, a very dangerous crime. Now, as long as Sheva ben Bichri remains outside the walls of the city of Eva Mochala, he's David's headache and he's Yoav's headache. The moment he enters the city, he becomes their headache. Not only does he become their headache, the moment he enters into the walls of the city, he puts them in danger. He endangers their lives because he is being pursued by the army of David. He knows there's an army pursuing him. He willingly enters their city. In so doing, invites the danger upon the inhabitants of the city.
In that way, the story is the same.
Is that, yeah.
Right? So well, we'll get to Shimshon in a second. Just look at that story for a second. So here's your scenario. Individual committed a crime or has done something wrong, and in his crime has put the lives of other innocent individuals in danger. He is endangering their lives. What do the people of Eva Mochala do?
Nothing.
They kill him.
Yeah.
Oh, but
they kill him.
Until somebody comes.
Now, one of the questions that we're bothered by, that's true, because they don't realize the danger until that point, or they have to be convinced of it, or maybe they wanted to side with him. But okay, that's her chachma. But her chachma wasn't to hand Sheva ben Bichri over. Her chachma was to kill him. Why? That piece of it we haven't really dealt with. Why did she kill him? Why didn't she just take him alive and throw him out the wall?
I'm going to say it's to show that they were on the side of David.
Maybe. But I think there's a halachi principle operating here too.
Well, if he deserved to be punished, they needed to punish him. You know? As opposed to letting somebody else punish him.
What if I'm... Let's extrapolate the story down to a core. Person A is actively endangering the life of person B. I'm standing on the side and watching this. Person A, actively endangering the life of person B. Willingly endangering the life of person B. Classic example, somebody's pursuing somebody else to kill them.
Mm-hmm. You're obliged to take action.
You're obliged to take action, how?
By killing them first.
Killing the pursuer.
Right.
That halacha is called Rodef. Mm-hmm. That's the halacha of a rodef. A rodef is a pursuer. Mm-hmm. The biblical verse, not to stand idly by the blood of your neighbor. Have a pursuer. He's actively pursuing, endangering the life of somebody, of an innocent person. You are obligated to act. If you can't harm, if you can't stop the crime by maiming them, you are allowed to kill them. Take a look at source 8. That's the Rambam. Second line, harodef achar chavero lehargo, if a person pursues a fellow to kill them, afilu haya harodef katan, even if the pursuer is a minor. And there's a reason for the formulation that way, I'll tell you what it is in a second. Harei, kol Yisrael mitzuvim lehatzil hanirdaf miyad harodef. All of Israel is obligated to save the pursued from the hands of the pursuer. Va'afilu b'nafsho sharodef. Even with the life of the rodef. Now, in actual practical terms, this is a very interesting halachic application, which is why the formulation of the rodef hakatan is mentioned here. It's the formulation of why you're allowed to abort a fetus if the fetus endangers the mother.
So that's why.
Because the fetus has the status of a rodef if it is endangering the mother's life.
Wow. Interesting.
Right. Now, in the case of Sheva ben Bechri, the notion of a rodef is extrapolated into all kinds of interesting halachic applications. For example, in the Middle Ages, it was a very common phenomenon. If you had somebody who was guilty, for example, of committing a crime against the state, the tshuvas, for example, about somebody who was forging counterfeit money, and you knew about it, and you're allowed to hand him over to the authorities, knowing that the authorities are going to execute him. And the answer was that he's endangering the lives of everybody around him. By doing this, he's involved in a crime. The authorities catch him. They're going to capture and they're going to kill. This is not in a society where law and order was, you know, justice was pursued fairly and equally. And he was endangering the lives of everybody in the community. So you could get rid of him. You could hand him over to the authorities, knowing that they were going to harm him, because he was actively endangering their lives. He was a rodef. So the notion of a rodef is applicable not just to a person who's running after somebody with a gun, but to somebody whose behavior endangers the behavior of others, or endangers the lives of others. The reason why the principle of rodef is so valuable for us in this story of Sheva ben Bechri is because it really is the only explanation as to why they actually kills him. They actually kill him. They don't hand Sheva ben Bechri over. They... A little of the graphic. I was going to spare you the graphic description, but yeah. But they executed him on the guillotine, and that's really what a rodef is. You have the right to take the life of the person endangering everybody else. If I come back to the story of Shimshon, the most likely logic to the behavior of Bnei Yehuda was not that they looked at the Seft of Truma and said, okay, what's the halacha here? The halacha is, if he's in danger and we're in danger, and he's inside and he's outside, and they designated somebody, they didn't designate somebody, it's a whole complex halachic principles based on the Mishnah and Trumas and the Tosefta and the Yerushalmi. I don't think they really analyzed it like that. Well, how did they analyze it?
Simply,
Shimshon, how dare you? So you go into the world of the Plishtim, and you kill hundreds of them. And then you come and you hide with us? And you invite the entire Plishtim army to come marching on our door? What is this? They looked at him as a rodef. You put us in danger. How do I know that that's how they looked at it? And that's how they perceived it. Yeah, because their argument to Shimshon, I'm sure it is. The argument to Shimshon wasn't just, Shimshon, our lives are in danger, why don't we negotiate a way out of this? That wasn't their argument. What was their argument to Shimshon?
They're looking for you.
They need more than that. They're looking for somebody. Right? Even more than that, what did they say? Go back to the story for a moment. Perek Tetvav. They go down to Shimshon, remember, with 3,000 people. And they said to him,
we're going to try and help him.
Let's start with Pasuk Yud Aleph. Vayardu shloshet alafim ish miyuda el siif sela etam. 3,000 Bnei Yehuda go down to siif sela etam. The first thing they said to Shimshon, chapter 15, verse 11, Tetvav Yud Aleph. The first words out of their mouth to Shimshon is not, Shimshon, let's figure a way out, our lives are in danger, you're endangering our lives. First thing they said is, Vayomul Shimshon, Halo yadata ki moshlim banu plishtim. Don't you know that the plishtim are in charge here? Don't you know that the Plishtim are the ruling power? Umazot asita lanu. What have you done to
us?
What have you done to us? What have you done to us, meaning? Not by coming here and hiding. They're not accusing him of coming here and hiding and therefore endangering their lives. What are they accusing him of? Insubordination and rebellion against the ruling power. They're accusing him of treason. The plishtim are ruling over us. The plishtim are our masters and lords. What have you done to us by instigating against them, by fighting them, by killing plishtim? Not a nice thing to do, killing plishtim. Shimshon. It's past nisht.
So why didn't they kill
him? Vayomer lehem. Oh, why didn't they kill him? I'll answer that question in a second. Vayomer lehem. So what's Shimshon's answer? Kasher asalik and asita lehem. What are you talking about? They started it up with me. Remember that whole story, right? Who started it first? We've come to bind you. We've come to tie you up. We've come to hand you over. Not because we want to save our lives and not because we want to negotiate over the laws of this paragraph or that paragraph. Shimshon, you are a terrorist. And we are going to hand you over like a terrorist. How dare you? You are endangering our lives. You are a rodef. You are a terrorist. Get out of here. Now, and you are correct. Why didn't they do what they did to Sheva ben Bechri, which is to chop his head off and hand it over the wall, right?
Mm-hmm.
Answer.
They were afraid?
No.
Sheva ben Bechri is Sheva ben Bechri, and Shimshon
is Shimshon.
If you need 3,000 soldiers to go negotiate this with Shimshon, Isha b'chochmata, that one woman could execute Sheva ben Bechri. I need 3,000 soldiers from Shevet Yehuda to talk to Shimshon. And he says to them, Shimshon says, "Vayomalem Shimshon, ishavulu pentiv kubinatem. I'll cooperate. Just promise me that you're not going to start up with me. Why? Because I don't want to hurt you. It's one against 3,000. I don't want to hurt you." And they understand this very well. We're going to hand you over. We're going to tie you up, but we will not kill you. We won't start up with you. Not to worry. We'll be very peaceful. You come quietly, and we'll behave, because you're Shimshon, and we know it.
But it's not going to even. If they tie him up, he's just going to break through.
Well, they didn't know that.
They didn't know.
So they tied him up with fresh ropes.
Yeah.
Tied him up with strong rope. Right?
It takes 3,000 to come to talk to him. They
That's
think
right.
It's really going to.
But. The tenor of the conversation here is not a tenor of a conversation about the fact that, these enemy plishtim, they've put an ultimatum to us that Nebuch, we don't have a choice, we have to hand over one of our numbers in order to save the rest of us. The tenor of the conversation here is they're right and you're wrong.
And they want to get rid of him.
Right? They're the plishtim. We have respect for the plishtim. You are a terrorist. We'll get rid of you. You're the problem. Get out of here.
That's what's
wrong. Right? Here's the irony of it. Why did he go to Shevet Yehuda in the first place?
That's where his family was.
That was his family. That was his mother's family. You remember Sivsel Eitam? Eitam, Slopani, the whole connection to the mother?
Right.
He came to them for help. He came to them to he really came to them.
What was protection?
He really came to them because it was time to. Think about the model of Sefer Shoftim. Think about all the different times that we've had moments of critical decision. Here's the shofet, here's the enemy ruling power, here's the people, and it's time to make a change.
Right.
Remember the story of Ehud, when Sefer Shoftim began, when we started with Sefer Shoftim. The story of Ehud. He goes and he kills the king of Moab. Remember that story? The knife in the belly? It's kind of almost equally as graphic.
Yeah.
Kills the king of Moab, comes back to Israel. It's the first thing he does.
Raises an army.
Blows the shofar, raises an army, and says, okay, they're vulnerable. Let's get them. They're vulnerable. Let's go. Devorah, Barak, they're vulnerable. Go. The role of a shofar is to raise the people to follow into battle against the enemy. The whole point of the Sefer is to establish Jewish sovereignty and to recognize that when sovereignty is threatened by an outside power, it's a punishment. If people do tshuva, remove the outside power and change the course of Jewish history. Here's Shimshon. He's attacked the Plishtim. The Plishtim are vulnerable. They're marching on B'nai Yehuda. Shimshon goes running to B'nai Yehuda. I can't escape the possibility or the impression that maybe Shimshon was hoping for a somewhat different outcome, which was, okay, let's do something here.
He hid in a rock. He didn't, at least the way...
Why did he hide in a rock?
Well, he wasn't trying to raise an army to fight the...
Maybe, unless he came to there and said, okay, where's your army? And they said, what army? And they said, oh, against the Plishtim. And they said, we don't have an army against the Plishtim. Well, the Plishtim are coming. Oh, Shimshon, you better hide. Right? But the notion that they never lift a finger, the mentality of B'nai Yehuda is not Shimshon Acharai. Maybe it's Shimshon's fault. Maybe he didn't try. But it was a missed opportunity on both parts. On both parts. That's really what should have happened. Here is the opportunity to bring B'nai Yehuda into the picture, bring an army together, go fight the Plishtim. And instead, Shimshon's hiding in a rock. The Plishtim say to him, the Plishtim ruling over us, acquiescence and acknowledgement that that's the political reality. There's no sense of Jewish pride, there's no sense of Jewish identity, of Jewish sovereignty, nothing. They live as subjugated subjects of the Plishtim ruling over the land of Israel, which is, in the world view of Tanakh, an untenable scenario. And then, to add insult to injury, they turned to Shimshon and they said, you know what? Our one hero, our one guy who's prepared to stand up against the Plishtim, we're going to hand you over. Midin Rodef!
But his whole thing until now, he's really been acting
on his own.
He hasn't been in...
Correct. And this is the first time he runs to a group. The first time we...
He's got these people following him.
That's right. He's got an entire army following him. He runs into Shevet Yehuda, that's the moment. You expect something to happen here. And when nothing does, you kind of have this sense of loss. What kind of behavior was this? Take Shimshon, hand him over to the Plishtim.
This is also sort of like the 10 plagues. Because then he takes up the bone and he kills them all.
So he does what he needs to do, but in the meantime, the opportunity of having a following of the B'nai Yehuda was lost.
Shimon Shah at this point is on his own.
Right. He's still on his own. He will stay on his own. He always operates on his own.
Yeah.
I just can't escape the question of what could have happened had B'nai Yehuda behaved differently. Now, the extent to which that question gnaws at us will become much more evident in the next part of the story. Because the subsequent part of the story, which we haven't read yet, we haven't really looked at, is what happens after the battle. That's really a very telling moment for us. It's an insight into the world view of Shimshon. It's the first time Shimshon really communicates with God. And it's a very important conversation. So we will move into that conversation, B'ezrat Hashem, next week. And we're going to end a few minutes early today, because I have a...